What's up, Stitches? It's time for episode 7 of this season of So What? Yeehaw! Today's episode is an interview, and it's a real treat, especially because it's about medieval textiles. I haven't delved into medieval needlework on the podcast yet, other than the episode about knoll binding, so it's awesome to talk to an expert on the subject about researching it and making it. That expert is textile archaeologist and embroiderer Dr. Alexandra Macon. Alexandra is a textile archaeologist who specializes in early medieval embroidery. She's also a professional embroiderer with a background in archaeology and textiles who has trained at the Royal School of Needlework. Her PhD was titled Embroidery and Its Context in the British Isles and Ireland during the Early Medieval Period, AD 450 to 1100, which honestly sounds so rad. It is on my to-read list, and I hope now it is on yours as well. In 2019, she came out with a book called The Lost Art of the Anglo-Saxon World, The Sacred and Secular Power of Embroidery. This is what Alexandra says about her work and research interests. Quote, "My areas of research focus on early medieval material culture, mainly embroidery, but other aspects too. I am particularly fascinated by how material culture entwined with and influenced early medieval life. I am interested in experimental archaeology and how this can inform our understanding of the objects we find and data we gather from documentary and visual sources. Such approaches are also important in helping us understand working methods and organization and their development during the early medieval period. I have a special interest in the Bayeux tapestry, which has led to the uncovering of new facts about its embroidering." End quote. Alexandra is currently in the midst of recreating the St. Cuthbert embroideries, which are a surviving stole, maniple, and ribbons, all from the 10th century. These are recorded as being given to the shrine of St. Cuthbert by King Athelstan. I don't know how to pronounce that, but I think that's how you pronounce it. Athelstan. Athelstan? Who knows? Not me. Anyway, King Athelstan, when he visited Chester-le-Street in 934 AD, and they are some of the finest surviving examples of Anglo-Saxon embroidery in England. They are now held by Durham Cathedral. We talk about those embroideries quite a bit in the episode, and honestly, it is a delight all around. Alexandra is also about to begin her role as the postdoctoral research associate on the Unwrapping the Galloway Hoard project. It's an AHRC-funded project with the National Museum of Scotland and the University of Glasgow. She'll be working with Dr. Susanna Harris in the Archaeology Department at the University of Glasgow, technically analyzing and researching the wider contexts of the textiles and leather that were found in the hoard, which is the richest collection of rare and unique Viking Age objects ever found in the United Kingdom. I truly think Alexandra is so cool, honestly so cool, and I loved learning more about early medieval embroidery from her because I honestly know very little about embroidery from that period other than the Bayeux tapestry. Truly, most of what I know about needlework from that period comes from her Twitter feed, where she's always sharing fascinating images and information about centuries and millennia-old textiles and progress photos of her own recreation medieval embroidery. You'll hear more about that in the interview. As always, of course, I gotta tell you that images of what we discussed today, as well as links to all of Alexandra's work and social media, are on the So What social media pages at So What Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or at sowhatpodcast.com. Love to share content, love to provide a way for this not very visual medium of podcasting to become visual, right? Yay, delight. Okay, now let's get to the interview. Get ready to step back in time more than 1,000 years and learn all about some hip-hop and medieval stitchery. Here we go. Alexandra, thank you so much for being here today. I'm really excited to get to talk to you and learn about your work. How did you come to research early medieval embroidery?
Well, that's a funny story, really. After I finished my 3-year apprenticeship at the Royal School of Needlework, which is really intense, I don't think people always understand how intense it is, but it is, I decided I didn't want to look at another piece of embroidery, let alone pick up a needle again. So I went up to Newcastle upon Tyne and I studied an undergraduate degree in my other love, and that's archaeology. But my brother happened to be studying at Durham, about 20 minutes down the road. And so we used to meet up and go out. And on one weekend, we went to Durham Cathedral, and I saw the stole maniple and probable ribbons. They're embroidered, and they were rediscovered in the tomb of St. Cuthbert in 1827. But they originally date to the early, about around 910, 916 AD. And I just was gobsmacked. They're the most fantastic, amazing embroideries, and the technique, the skill involved in creating them, it's unbelievable, really. I can remember having my nose pressed up against the glass, looking at these things in their cases, wishing I could get my hands on them. But it also dawned on me at the same time that this was archaeology and embroidery, and I could combine both my passions. And so that got me back into it, made me a little bit obsessed. And I would just then talk to anybody who would listen, and my friends who wouldn't listen, about early medieval embroidery. And it just went from there. So it's my brother's fault, really.
I love that. Also, I would have been your friend, and I would have been like, please tell me more. Please tell me more. Because really, the combination of embroidery and archaeology is, it's where I live. It's any of my loves as well. So thank you. Oh, the dream. Can you tell me more about early medieval embroidery? I'm thinking things like fibers, colors, motifs, stitches, etc.
I think it helps if we think about metalwork and things like that that survive, and the brilliant colours from the garnets and the other jewels, and the gold. There's a lot of that kind of colour occurring in embroidery from the period as well. So although things are often found and they're brown now, that when people analyse the colours and the dyes and things, they actually find these quite vivid tones in there. The materials themselves change throughout the period. So you start off in the early part of the period with locally grown fibres, so flax from linen, a little bit of nettle, sheep's wool, and things like that. And then with the coming of Christianity and that outward looking that happens, and the opening up of more exchange and leading on to trade routes and things throughout the period, you get things like silk coming in, the use of gold thread and that sort of thing. And they also embellish the embroideries with pearls and jewels, which tend not to survive, unfortunately. Yeah. So there's a wide range of material. I say a wide range of materials, considering the fact that they weren't making manufactured materials in the sense that we need them today, that kind of thing. Motifs, lots of different motifs. You've got animals, foliage, geometric, arcades, all inscriptions interlaced, knotwork. And it all links in with what you see happening in artwork and other materials around the same time as well. So you can see that there's this interlinking going on and this transfer of ideas and things like that, and transfer of meanings and stuff as well. And stitches, the most popular stitches are stem stitch and split stitch. You've obviously got couching, which some people call couching laid work, and Bayer stitch from the Bayer tapestry. There's a really cool stitch called loop stitch, and there's a number of variations of that, which you see early in the period, that it seems to disappear. We've got no evidence for it surviving, and then it comes back again when the Vikings come and settle and things like that. So that's really cool. And then you get functional stitches as well, such as running stitch, buttonhole stitch, used decoratively, and to a lesser extent, you'll see a bit of chain stitch and satin stitch. Underside couching comes in later, so there's a couple of examples of that. So there's a wide variety of stitches, well, some of which we still use today, which is fantastic, because you've got continuity and that link back then. So I find that fascinating.
Love that. They were doing it all, man. They had all stitches, all their motifs. So what embroideries from the period survive? I'm assuming that beyond the Bayeux tapestry, there are some other things.
Yeah, there are.
Yay.
So most things that survive tend to be either really small things from the archaeological record, which you can't always, you have a little bit of it and you know it's embroidery, but you can't always say what it was originally. But there's things like the gorgeous Kempston fragment, which might have been a decorative band, possibly. And then you've got this lovely seam that's been covered in a complex variation of loop stitch, and that was found in the ship burial, Man 1 at Sutton Hoo. And it's been postulated that that was either a bag or a pillow covering something like that, which is quite cool. You get a lot of surviving evidence from ecclesiastical settings, because obviously things were stored differently and or used as relics, touch relics and things like that. So we've got stoles, maniples, the ribbons, which I think some people still call a girdle from the tomb of Saint, but and things like that. And we've also got, linking back to the Sutton Hoo piece, there's actually a piece from York that's later in date that uses the same stitch, but it hems a cuff of a sleeve, which is
yeah. That's really, like, poignant. There is such a connection there. I love that.
Yeah, totally, yeah. From Wales, there's a tunic.
A full tunic.
Very, very smart. And then you get things like from the later period, shoes, where they've got what we call the vamp, the centre seam has been embroidered with lines of stitching and things like that as well, or around the edges, around the ankles and things. So lots of different types of fragments and from lots of different objects. And we know from documentary sources as well that they love textiles and that the houses had loads of them if they could afford them, and the clothes did, and they were decorated in embroidery, really vivid colours. We might consider them quite garish, but I quite like them.
Oh yeah.
It was all over the place.
I love that. And it's something I think about all the time, which is there's always this innate human desire and need to make things beautiful. Like desire to decorate is so apparent, and we've had it forever.
Because you always get movements, don't you, that try and shunt all that to the side and say, no, you mustn't have decoration, iconoclasm and all of that business. But it always comes back again.
So how does your practice as a professional embroiderer inform your academic research and vice versa? Because you do it all. You do it all so wonderfully.
I try.
Yes.
So my work is multidisciplinary. My embroidery side obviously brings a knowledge and understanding of working methods, the use of materials and how they work. And that kind of innate learnt knowledge that your hand and eye do what's needed to be done without you having to actually think about it, which then gives me insight into the skill sets and the thought processes of the early medieval embroiderers. And to do that, I recreate pieces using materials as close to the originals and equipment as close to the original as possible. But obviously we have better lighting and magnifying glasses, things like that, which really do help. so that helps me on that side of things. And also how the equipment and the materials interact together, and maybe therefore the choices that people were making in order to produce what they're being commissioned to make. And then that helps me with my analysis of the embroideries, because I know what I'm looking for and I can say, that stitch has been placed here, possibly. I mean, we'll never know 100%, but that stitch has been placed here possibly because of A, B, C, and D. Because when you stitch it in this material, this fabric, using this type of needle, you've got to make it that way. And that's that kind of thing. So it isn't just about observing the stitches all the time, and it's about how they're made, how they interact with each other. And it's not until you sometimes it's not until you can look at the back of a piece and then you can make a piece yourself that you can unravel perhaps secrets that you didn't even know were there.
That's what
it's like, a detective story, and I love that without a dead body, which would be a bit freaky, but I love that. And then the academic side brings rigor to my work, and it enables me to take theoretical approach, like sensory archaeology, object biography, things like that. I can relate them to the actual pieces, to the practical side of things. Yeah, it's a general all-round engagement with it, I think. And I think one bounces off the other. And without one or the other, I don't think, well, I would argue I wouldn't have been able to uncover some of the stories that I've been able to.
Can you tell me more about the Cuthbert Recreation Project? I see it on Twitter all the time. I love every post. I feel very invested. So I would love to learn more, and I'd love for So What listeners to learn more as well.
When I was doing my PhD research, I wasn't able to access the embroideries. They were hermetically sealed in storage at the time because they were Durham Cathedral was investing in a new gallery for them. And then when I was converting my PhD into a book, I asked if I could go and analyse them for the book. And they were deemed to be too fragile, which I totally understand. So the last thorough analysis of them was undertaken by a lady called Elizabeth Plenderleith when the stole maniple and the ribbons were taken to the British Museum for cleaning. And she analysed them from a technical perspective. Other people analysed them from an art historical perspective and that side of things. And then all these reports were published in a huge volume, edited by Batterscombe, C.F. Batterscombe, and it was published in 1956. So, and people, everyone obviously relies on this report and chapter. And I have to say that it's amazing. The technical detail that Elizabeth got out of it was, second to none. It's fantastic. But with the update of new microscopic analysis and things like that, I thought maybe I could add to what she's already discovered.
Yes.
But obviously that avenue was closed down due to the fragility of the embroideries. So I was like, right, well, how can I learn more about these amazing embroideries that I'm really not in love with at all? And I was discussing with a friend and I thought, why don't we mooted the idea of recreating part of one. So I was like, yeah, that's a brilliant idea. Oh dear. So I managed to get funding for a Janet Arnold grant from the Society of Antiquaries of London. And originally the project was for a year, and I was going to use, and I have used, materials that are as close to the originals as possible. I decided to focus on the maniple. I have no idea why, really. I think it was because when I was reading, going through the technical report again, the maniple, the ground fabric on the maniple has more threads per inch than the stole. And I was like, that's really interesting. I'll focus on the maniple. And partway through the project, I was thinking, why did I do this? Why? And it would have been so much easier with less threads per inch. Like I say, it was meant to take a year, but it took a year to gather the materials together. That became a huge collaborative project, finding people who could weave the fabric, finding the right threads, dyeing them with natural dyes to get the right tones and things like that. It was a brilliant project in itself. And then when I got all of that, I started stitching after transferring the design onto the fabric and things. So by stitching and using equipment and materials, as I say, that are as close to the originals, I've been investigating not only what Elizabeth Plenderleith put in her report, but also kind of, why did the embroiderer choose to do it like this? Why did they count count the stitches to the ground fabric, and why is this stitch turned out like that, and how have they got that, how have they got that finished effect, and all of this kind of, what's the thought processes, how do the materials interact with each other, and all of this sort of thing. So it's a huge project investigating how equipment works with materials, but also everything that I've just outlined as well. So I've finished stitching it, and now I'm researching possible equipment for flattening the gold. We don't have any identified equipment for how they flatten the gold and everything. So I'm just doing that, and also stitching other pieces that aren't quite so mind-boggling.
That is good. What, like, a delightful pandemic task to figure out what somebody more than 1,000 years ago did to flatten some gold. Your friends in the pub eventually, and they'll be like, oh my god, how'd you pass your time? And you'll be like, well, I've just been flattening some gold.
Yeah, exactly.
What is your favorite needleworked object or objects? You are welcome to choose more than one.
I don't have a favorite.
Okay, that's so fair.
I have ones I like for different reasons. So from my apprenticeship, I love my black work, taken from the poster of a Hamlet film. I love black work anyway, but I love that. And my silk shading that I did. And it's funny because those are the two of my favourite techniques as well.
Ooh.
From my research, I think it's got to be the Kempston fragment. I mean, the Kempston fragment's tiny, teeny tiny, but I just, yeah, it just captured me. I think it's partly because I was able to rewrite its history and its biography and add to what other people had done before. And it's that detective thing again, and find and the excitement of finding out new information and getting it out there. That's just so cool. I love
There's
that.
No better feeling. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, generally, across the board, I mean, that's one of the great things about social media, isn't it? The fact that people can post their work on social media and stuff now. And so it's, you don't always have to end up going to a gallery, sometimes, which obviously at the moment we can't do anyway, but yeah. You're still getting to see gorgeous embroidery and all different varieties and types. And sometimes I look at things and I was like, wow, that's amazing. I've never thought of doing that myself.
Definitely.
I get inspired by a lot of different types and styles and from people all around the world. And I can't really pick on one.
That is so fair. And actually, your answer leads really well into the next question. So congratulations.
Thank you.
The other big question that I love to ask people, which you've already kind of answered, what do you think the role of needlework is in today's world?
Well, I mean, I think obviously with pandemics being as they are at the minute, I think it's revived embroidery as a hobby for people, as just as a form of relaxation, learning new skills, but also to help mentally. I mean, it's been known for a long time, hasn't it, that craft, knitting, embroidery, and lots of different type of craft can help people mentally and through depression. And I think that that's a really big thing at the moment, particularly with the lockdowns we've had and things like that. Generally, out of that sphere, those same themes apply. And it's really interesting also that to see how many young people have taken up embroidery and are now doing that as a career. So relevant and can be done as a career as well. I think that is that's really cool. There's also the aspect that so many people see people sitting there stitching away very daintily, but actually embroidery has always been imbued with messages, and that could be religious, metaphorical, just getting your angst out there, like nowadays through craftyism and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But there's huge political messages and things that you can see coming down through history. And obviously with this year, there's been a lot of political activism on different fronts, and you've seen things come out through embroidery and things like that. I think that's really important. Oh yeah, you've got Dr. Biden's outfit at the inauguration.
Yeah.
This isn't embroidery, but who is that politician's mittens?
Oh, Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders mittens, you know, and the fact that actually there was an ecological message going on with those as well. And I think embroidery and craft is really good for that whole recycling, reusing, and that links us back to what's gone on throughout history and slow fashion and all of this sort of thing. Embroidery is really relevant to today, and it covers all aspects. It's just, I think sometimes it's so embedded in our psyche that you don't necessarily think about it or open that box and realise that that's what's going on. But it is. It's out there with all these different messages and linking to all these different ideas. It's not just a hobby.
When you said that, I just had this like motto in my head, which was needlework, more relevant than ever before.
Totally.
I don't know if it's more relevant than ever before, but just as relevant as as relevant as it has been for its entire history. It's maybe changed forms in certain ways, but I don't think it's lost any of its impact or importance. And finally, the last question, how can people learn more about your work? And do you have anything you'd like to promote?
Ooh, thank you for asking that question.
Oh, I just wanted to help you be your best business self.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. Well, I'm on Twitter, as you know, and I'm on Instagram as well. So on Twitter, it tends to be more about early medieval embroidery and other material culture linked to early medieval stuff. And I sometimes throw in a bit to do with gardens and plants.
Ooh, yeah.
And then on Instagram, it's mainly about my projects. So the Cuthbert recreation project and projects I'm working on at the moment and things like that. And again, I throw in plants and nature. And stuff.
We love nature.
You can never have enough. I've got a website which you can access through both Twitter and Instagram. And on that, you'll find information about my publications and stuff. But also, and most importantly, I have a monthly blog where I ask people to contribute. And you're going to contribute, I know this, next year.
Woo!
So I ask people to contribute and write about a certain aspect of their work. And it's mainly to do with the early medieval period, and obviously it's textiles and related. But for really interesting things like yours, I do step out of the period.
Yeah.
And it's not just researchers, it's makers, conservators, academics. It's the whole works. I try and get as many people involved as possible and across the world as well. So check that out. It comes out on the first of the month. And it's free. That's really important.
We love some free content.
Yeah, well, and it's about getting people interested in this amazing period and textiles and things and embroidery. It's so important. So it's free. And you can join the list, so it pings you when I upload, or you can just go on and find out what's on there. And I'm in the process of setting up a YouTube channel.
Oh,
where it's just at the moment, it's going to be little snippets showing how, for example, I did different aspects of little videos, showing how I did different aspects of the Cuthbert embroidery and other projects. And then if people want to ask me questions about things, technical or otherwise, they're more than welcome to. It's about public engagement and getting people excited and involved in a medieval embroidery. And at the moment, I'm working on a project book. There'll be 6 projects, 2 for beginners, 2 for when you're feeling more confident, and then 2 for experts. And the designs are based on the early medieval period. And it's, again, to encourage people to explore that period more and to get embroidering and creative. So, yeah, so there's lots on the go. And social media, perfect place. So
definitely.
Yeah.
This is all so exciting. And thank you for all that you do to make early medieval embroidery accessible and interesting and fun. And also, can I suggest a YouTube video of you flattening gold?
Yes, I'd already thought of that. I will.
Alexandra, thank you so much for being here today. I have enjoyed this conversation so, so much. Thank you.
And thank you for having me.
Yay!
What a treat of an interview, right? I hope you learned as much as I did, because really, truly, I learned so much. Also, special shout out to Alexandra, because for the first time in my entire podcasting career, I recorded the interview and it just absolutely did not work, so we had to record it again. But it was fun for me, because twice the early medieval embroidery content. Yay! I'm really excited to finally have some medieval embroidery stuff on the pod, because it's an incredibly rich, vibrant, and fascinating field of knowledge and research I know not a huge amount about. But what Alexandra taught me, which I absolutely love, is that even though a lot of medieval embroidery looks faded to us, it was super bright and garish and all over the place. I love that no matter how much things change, humans always have the desire to make their surroundings beautiful and bright. Textiles have always been useful and decorative. I love, love, love seeing and feeling those shared qualities across centuries. Needlework is out here weaving the narrative of thousands of years of humanity together. The power it has! And on that powerful and nicely optimistic note, that's it for me this week. Thanks for listening, and thank you to Alexandra for teaching me a heck of a lot about early medieval embroidery. I love to learn! And you do too, or else you would not be here. Yay! Look at us gaining knowledge. What a delight. Now go out and stitch some stories and go flatten some gold. Bye!